You're listening to an Iconic exclusive, which is an interview that we do with one of the industry designers or participators with 13th Age. Due to the nature of the interview, this podcast may run a little bit longer than our normal episodes, as we're just going to let the person we're interviewing talk and answer our questions, and we're going to have a good time doing it. So just be warned, this one may run longer than what you're normally used to listening to.
This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick. Iconic exclusive.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Today we have a very special treat for you. We have Rob Heinsu and Ash Law on here to talk about the new 13th Age Glorantha Kickstarter. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello. We're glad to be here.
Rob is a returning guest, but Ash, this is your first time on Iconic. How did you get involved with 13th Age?
So it started with a mojito. I was
as all good stories do.
As all good stories do. So I was at NorwestCon 5 years back, and I was up at Maxie's bar, and it was after everything at the convention was closed, and it's the only place to get a drink, well, one of two places to get, the best place to get a drink there. And the queue was really long. I was like, if I order a drink now, and I go back to the table with my friends, and I drink it, that means I have to queue up again to get another drink. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to want to drink two mojitos tonight, not just one. So I thought, okay, I'll get myself two mojitos. So I got the two mojitos. I turn around. To my right is this old gentleman, very, very dignified looking, with a large beard, and I recognize him from somewhere, but I don't know where. You know, maybe I've played a game with him. Maybe, do I owe this person some money? Do I owe this man money? Is that... So I turned to him and I said, I think I owe you a beer. I'm not sure why I know you, but I know you from somewhere. So, will you accept a mojito? And he said yes, and he came back to our table. It turned out he was Jonathan Tweet. I was like, Jonathan Tweet, the name rings a bell. Why does the name ring a bell? Were you on a panel? I saw it. Yeah, I was doing a panel earlier. Okay, right. So we talked for a bit, and he was like, well, what games are you into? And I'm like, right now we're playing 4th edition D&D. It's written by this guy called Rob Heinsu, and we really like it. He's like, oh, I know Rob Heinsu. I'm like, oh, okay. But I also like, some older indie-style games. So I don't know if you've heard of it, but this game called Over the Edge. And he's like,
did you really do that, Jonathan? Oh,
yeah.
God.
And then I was like, and, stuff like Banshee and stuff like, and he's like, oh, I am aware of these games. And there's this really obscure one, which I love the pants off. It was called Everway. It was so ahead of your time. You've probably not heard of it. He was like, you know what? You're kind of our core audience here. So what we got coming up?
Jonathan just let you keep going that way.
He just let you keep going, and it turns out that Jonathan had written all these like indie style games, but I love. And I even went off on one and started gushing about how great Ars Magical was. He was like, yeah, I'm aware of that game too. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, man.
So,
in other words, you couldn't have done any better if you'd been, like, super pandering.
So we got chatting, and he invited me into the beta for 13th Age. And so we started doing that, and I started posting up magic items on Google+. Here's a great 30-page magic item, and I agreed to run some stuff at conventions. And then one convention, I think it was Wade Rocket and Jay Schneider and Gerald Lynn, I think, was there. And Conan came up to me at the end of one particular convention and said, hey, what do you know about 13th Age? And I was like, oh, I know, yeah, okay. Well, what do you know about organized play for 13th Age? And I was like, I think there should be some. I think it's a good idea. And they were like, would you like to do it? Would you like to be in charge of that? And I was like, yeah, okay. Provided you guys buy me a mojito, it's all good. So that's how I end up running the organized play for 13th Age. All because of a mojito and the fact that I couldn't remember James.
That is, I don't know. Actually, if you're going to forget the author of a game, somehow forgetting over the edge feels particularly good. You know?
It feels right.
You know, it's somehow just writing over the edge scrubbed Jonathan's name recognition patterns, right?
That's right.
It's like, no, sorry, under the radar. Because I had this happen another time, too. Look, I'm jumping into your story, Ash. Can I talk? All right. So,
go ahead. You have talking stick. Go ahead.
When I was living in California working at Chaosium, I got a letter and then a letter or two and a phone call from a friend who lives in Port Angeles. And he described this crazy game that he and some friends, who I think some of them had been in his martial arts class, were playing in a barn out in Port Angeles. And they were making diaries of their characters and doing art and, like, composing a little bit of music. And it was a role-playing game. And it was set on some island. And there were all these conspiracies, at which point I'm like, is this over the edge? And the hilarious part was he had never seen the book. The Game Master had not told them that necessarily. I don't think they fully knew that it was over the edge. They were doing a thing. And sure enough, it did turn out to be over the edge. So then years later, I got to, you know, introduce my friend Steve, Jonathan, and it was very fun. It's like, these guys played over. And I think the thing is, I think the campaign was really, really powerful and out there really, really deeply weird, right? And so, you know, it ended, and then years later, Steve got to meet Jonathan, so that was great. But for a little while, I'd heard about this before finally, you know, several times I'd heard about it, and then I was like, wait a minute, they put it all together. So it's good. I love the way the culture can surprise us, and I think that if I ever have that experience of, like, telling somebody of all the things and it then turns out to be them, I'm going to think of you, Ash.
That's right. Well, great. And Jonathan had a great story. He just had to keep saying nothing and letting it unfold, so now he's got a great story.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, you know, and that is actually one of Jonathan's skills. He has self-control and timing. So that, you know, some people would blurt earlier, that's me! but Jonathan, no, he kept his cool, so that's pretty good.
So, actually, I was in a game store earlier, and I was talking to a guy, and he was all, my parents are coming over, and I'm going up to Canada in a bit to see them. And I'm bringing them up a copy of 13th Age Beastry because I worked on 13th Age Beastry, and they were like, oh, you must, you know, give us a book that you've had a hand in writing. And he was like, you could get the 13th Age Beastry, but you could also get the Midgard Beastry for 13th Age. It's a work of genius. It's by this guy, Ash Law. And I was like, really?
Well, by the time... By the time this podcast goes live... The Kickstarter should hopefully be live as well.
Yep.
Let's start off for those fresh-faced Glorantha newbies who have no clue what it is.
I'll interrupt you talking and say, that's me.
Yeah. So for Nick, who's never heard of Glorantha aside from, you know, me gushing about it, why don't you give us an introduction to the world?
I will start us out just a little bit. And then I will let Ash take over because I sort of looked at some of the questions ahead and realized that some of them are headed towards me and some of them and a couple can be headed towards Ash. So the one thing I'll say, and then I'll turn it over to Ash, is that of all the game fantasy game worlds that have ever been made, I think Glorantha is the one that really deals deeply with the different styles of gods and spirituality and religion and perspectives and how those all combine in a world with magic in which different fays all seeing themselves as the only good way to live collide and the myths shape the world and are still busy shaping the world. Over to you, Ash. What is Glorantha?
Glorantha, unless you want to, it's a world of living myth. So one of the things in the setting is it's a Bronze Age kind of setting. But when you actually read up on it, that's not actually bronze. That's the solidified blood of gods from former ages where they fell in battles and their blood cooled into a metal which has like special properties for certain things. And there's just like, you know, it's just like it tells us every part of the world is mythical, either is part of a myth or shaped by a myth, or you can point to a hill and say that hill is where so and so did such and such. That mountain is in fact where a god touched the earth. That place is where a god died and is buried. So every part of the setting is mythical, and it's a non-Tolkien, non-D&D, non-Gygaxian, if you will, fantasy. So with Tolkien-inspired fantasy, with medieval fantasy, with what we might term genre, I don't know, that particular genre thing, you have the standard tropes. You have, you know, you have the knights on horseback. You have castles. You have cities. You have, and some of that does exist in Glorantha, but much more of it is more Gilgamesh and Beowulf and those really old legends, the stuff which is not Robin Hood, but is not King Arthur, the stuff which came before, and it feels, and I think I'm with most 13 Mage fans in that those who have come into contact with Glorantha before but didn't really grok it were really intimidated because it's such a deep, wonderfully deep setting. And one of our things with 13 Mage and Glorantha is to make that come alive for newer players so that you have a jumping on point for the world of Glorantha.
Well, that's a good point, because I bought the guides to Glorantha at Gen Con and kept trying to meet up with Jeff to get his signature, and he was not at the booth for 24 hours, and I feel like my arms got larger for carrying around these 13.
You were carrying that around. Oh my God.
They were, my wife was like, that's a lot of books. So we actually weighed, they're 13 and a half pounds for the comprehensive guide to Glorantha to carry both of them around. So a more compact introduction is an admirable goal.
Well, there's a couple things going on, actually. I think before I talk specifically about 13th Age of Glorantha, I will say that one of the interesting things that's coming out of the project is that Jeff is going to create a smaller book, at least 128 pages, maybe a bit bigger than that, which is going to be an introduction basically just to the Dragon Pass area and a couple places around it that our game is really centered. And what that means is that instead of having the Guide to Glorantha, which really does cover the entire world, and in fact covers some pieces that people have not that often played games in, but the core of the world is an area named Dragon Pass, which gets its name partly because the mountains on the edges actually are dead dragons. They're giant backbones sticking out of the earth. And also because at one point in the world's history, the dragons killed every single person that lived in it. Mm-hmm. And that it stayed unpopulated for several hundred years. So Dragon Pass is the place we're going to focus on. And as a simpler focus really for the world, that the Kickstarter is going to include a book that people can get if they want to. It's going to be a smaller chunk, but a slightly different focus, I think. So I'm pretty happy about that. 13th Age of Glorantha, we're really, as Ash mentioned, I mean, our challenge is, in the same way that we in 13th Age were able to go ahead and say, hey, look, everybody knows there's an Archmage in every one of these fantasy worlds, so we've got one, and an Emperor, and a Dwarf King, and an Elf Queen. But then we kind of want players to be free to define things about those icons or who their organizations might be or what else might be happening in the world. We're trying to use that player-aided design and every individual campaign being different when we do 13th Age and Glorantha. We're not requiring that people know every single thing about what goes on in Glorantha. I mean, somebody who already does can very happily use that. But then when a player tells them, I'm a grandchild of Sir Ethelred, you know, that hero who lives over there, and he's not at all like what the books say he's like, then the game master can roll with that because, hey, man, this Glorantha is going to be different. But then for people who don't know Glorantha already, we're just going to be providing a certain number of pillars, the very basic facts, like Orlanth is the Storm King, and here's some myths about Orlanth, and Bernalda is the Queen of the Earth, and here's some myths about her. And once those myths are established, so you really get the flavor and people understand that, okay, the gods are the important thing, and that's the world, then the other details of what's going on, those can really be improvised by players and game masters if they want to. So I think it's going to be interesting because it's a definite, you know, it's an attempt to go ahead and say, please go ahead and make this game world your own, in the same way that 13th Age campaigns do. And people can draw on all the wonderful published stuff as much or as little as they want to, basically.
Excellent. Cool. So just what is this 13th Age and Glorantha Kickstarter? What do people expect out of it? What participation do you want?
I will go ahead and answer this one, Ash, for a minute, and then you should jump in if there's a good place for it. Because I'm trying, I'd rather not do all the talking, but then again, I know some of this. So, 13th Age and Glorantha Kickstarter is a collaboration between Jeff Richard of Moon Design and me and Jonathan Tweet and Ash, and as part of Fire Opal. And Pelgrane is usually the publisher for 13th Age, but this is a project that we're going to be publishing through Moon Design. And we're looking for just about $40,000 to start the Kickstarter starting point to go ahead and produce a book that should be at least 196 pages, is what I'm expecting. And it's going to be I don't believe in repeating rules. Like, I don't like to go ahead and publish a book and be like, oh, and here's all the rules again. So since this is a 13th Age compatible book, it's not going to have the regular 13th Age rules. You'll need 13th Age or some form of the rules to go ahead and play the game. And that also means that even though it's completely focused on giving classes and monsters and a gazetteer and write-ups of gods and rules for Glorantha and runes to set up so you can play a Glorantha campaign, The happy side for Dragon Empire players, or let's face it, anybody who's doing their own campaigns with 13th Age, which I actually wish I knew the percentages, but I don't know, is that you can use everything in this book in regular 13th Age games. I mean, you might want to change a couple of the flavor pieces, and we'll have notes about that. But all the classes, all the class variants, all the monsters, and the new icon relationship system, all of it perfectly applicable to regular 13th Age games. So in a big way, it's both a setting book and a new way to play and a whole bunch of stuff that you can just lift and plug into your game wherever you want to.
Are you going to need to change any of the mechanics of the game in order for it to fit into Glorantha?
I think so. Ash, do you want to take that one for a second?
So there are some things everything in 13th Age should be playable in 30th Age Glorantha and vice versa. But there are obviously going to be some changes. So if you, it's a setting where you don't have heavy armor as you would know it in a standard game of 13th Age. So you don't have steel plate mail because that just doesn't exist in the setting. So what we say is if you're playing in Glorantha, well, heavy armor means this thing, and light armor means this thing. And we stick with rules as is, and we just reflavor the heavy and light armor to go with the setting. Some things do change. We're changing up the icon relationship system, and Rob can talk more about that in a second. We are also providing a lot more options for players. So one thing that players have been saying is, can we have a more complicated version of, say, for example, the Ranger? Can we have a more complicated Ranger? Can we have more options for the fighter?
Or can we have a Barbarian?
Barbarian, exactly. Prime example. So we're doing a Berserker class, which is a Barbarian variant, and gives you more chaotic Berserkery stuff. It's a little deeper, perhaps, than the standard 13th base Barbarian. We've got some interesting stuff lined up for a class package. I guess it's a class package. We're calling it's the Windlord, but you can be a Windlord who is a Ranger, a Windlord who is a fighter, and Rob's got some exciting ideas for Windlords who are, in fact, rogues. But it's a load of stuff where you can go, okay, my fighter is a fighter, but he's a fighter who's a Windlord. Here's the cool Windlordy stuff that he gets, because it's a different take on the class from the standard 13th age fighter, which has been really fun working on that.
Yeah, the icon relationships part is, I think that I'm aware that, like, the number one question, you know, that comes up when we're doing panels is, hey, man, how do we handle icon relationship dice? And there are some answers that we've been, suggesting, and definitely got an article to write up at some point. But simultaneously, the Glorantan version of the icon relationship dice is going to be a little bit different. And I think that's really because icons are not gods, and the gods of Glorantha are, you know, they really are structured differently. It's not like you should be having, you know, they don't quite parse out into heroic, villainous, and ambiguous quite so easily, right. and positive and conflicted and negative relationships, which are the way that they work pretty well in 13th Age. Those structures don't quite make sense. And therefore, the fun part is that means we've got to rethink, hey, so what we, you know, let's forget the icon relationships rules in 13th Age. If we're doing it all over, we're doing it for Glorantha, what would that be? What would it look like? And the answer is, there are some things we're going to do that will be very fun, and the system will work and provide some of the same help, but hopefully it will also be less confusing sometimes. And you know, people will have an easier time going ahead and using it when in play. I'm happy because it also means, I think I've said this other times recently, that system will be perfectly back compatible with 13th Age. So you will be able, when you're running a 13th Age campaign or even an individual session, to say, you know, tonight we're going to use the Glorantha way, because that fits for what's going on in the campaign. And so in other words, it'll sort of be either you can use the Glorantha or you'll be able to use it as a tool in your regular 13th Age game. I think that's the biggest, if you talk about rules changes, that is the biggest one. The rest of it, you know, the goal is not to make rule changes because we don't have to. You know, the idea is it's a compatible product, and things are working pretty well. So I should, you know, as we talk, I'm going to scan the outline and see if I'm right about that. I think that, you know, they're actually that's right. When we get to my favorite things later on, I'll be able to talk about new rules. I mean, there are new rules and new exciting things, but that's not the, they're not changes because it's stuff that never existed in 13th Age.
Well, ironically, before this episode, we just recorded an entire episode on alternate uses for icon relationships and different ways to have them play out at the table.
And I bet you did. I should probably hear that before we're done with Glorantha.
Well, we'll send you a link to it as soon as
we're done. Because we set them straight.
All right, good. I'm glad to hear it. Excellent. All right.
So, Glorantha is very different, and I'm going to steal a term from you, Ash, than kind of typical Gygaxian fantasy. I'm actually writing a blog post where I try and delineate between that, and that's a really good way of saying it. It's not really Tolkien-esque anymore. It's kind of developed into its own genre.
It has become.
That's really fair. That's good. It's like it's good to give that due. Yep.
Yeah, and Glorantha is in a world of its own, so to speak. So how did you? I mean, 13th Age is very much Gygaxian planted. How did you come to the conclusion that, all right, let's make these changes and make it fit Glorantha and dovetail it in there and just send it out?
Well, okay, I think that this is one for me for a moment. If you look at my little signature stone that I used in 13th Age, it's actually full of Glorantha and runes.
Yes.
And I sort of believe that you're right to some extent about like the fact that we were clearly trying to be Gygaxian because it's very much in the D&D tradition, you know, the of what to expect because everybody understands that and knows it. But in terms of what the icons stand for and their power in the world and the way in which player characters are immediately related to the great powers of the world and have a stake in the big picture, those things are very much what Glorantha is about. So that the actual campaigns of 13th Age are occurring in a Gygaxian world, but oddly enough, I don't think you will find that the campaigns that are played with 13th Age of Glorantha will necessarily feel in that different in the sense it's like the scope of what happens because of the one unique thing, you know, with particular characters can sometimes be pretty extreme and pretty powerful. And that is really a style of gaming that I think both Jonathan and I came to love through Glorantha. I notice how I say it differently than everybody else. Greg Stafford says Glorantha. Glorantha. And I am, but you know, also the Kickstarter video mispronounces my own name, so I just believe we're in
nobody can pronounce your name,
Rob. Nobody pronounces the names right, and that's, you know, we're in a pre electronic world here where things get pronounced all different ways, and that's fine. And so,
we can say Gygaxian, and it just rolls off the tongue.
It does.
But Hansu.
No, it's not it. No, it's okay. I guess Hansu does roll off the tongue. It's the real one that's hard. So I guess in a weird way, I was designing 13th Age knowing that Glorantha would be an option for it. Mm. Like when I go ahead and like put in something called Gorgon's Maw and there's a giant demon underneath and the gold dragon is plugging up the abyss, you know, and holding people back, and the Crusader is taking Hellhole back from the Diabolus, and you know, the Iron Sea is actually hates the land and throws up Godzilla-sized monsters the whole time. Okay.
Yeah.
That's Glorantha. You know, that is me playing Glorantha with in a Gygaxian universe. And so that's definitely my answer. I mean, you know, Jonathan and I, of course, I mean, we both love Glorantha, so the whole time that we're working on it on 13th Age, we're sort of aware of the possibility of what we might do if it headed in that direction.
Oh, there are definite Glorantha touches in 13th Age. So if you're a listener,
there are.
If you take your core rulebook of 13th Age and flip to page 248 to the troll entry, it reads, okay, so it's trolls have rich lives of symbolic meaning as each individual relives the life of a legendary ancestor. They use ancient rituals in a forgotten tongue to mark their bibliographical and mythic milestones. Either that or they just wander around and eat things. And the second one, the either that or they just wander around and eat things in your traditional Gygaxian talk. The first bit of that paragraph is describing Glorantha and trolls. And it wasn't until I was looking at the Glorantha and trolls to write up the Ars Racial stuff for Glorantha, and I was like, hold on, the controls of the core book, they're describing the race that I'm writing. So it's interesting. So Glorantha treats certain fantasy tropes in a very different way than Gygaxian fantasy. So, for example, there are elves in Glorantha, but they're not Tolkien pointy-eared bow elves. Although there is room for that, they are plant elemental creatures from before man even walked the immortal realm. And the reason why they take humanoid forms is to make humanoids feel more comfortable around them. But really, they're more akin to what somebody who's used to kind of Tolkien-esque fantasy would think of as Ents or plant elementals. They just happen to take the shape of elves to make people more comfortable. Similarly, they're dwarves, but the dwarves are not your Tolkien-esque dwarves. They're elemental. They're tied to metals. They're obsessed with fixing the world machine and making the world once more work as it should. The trolls in Glorantha are this ancient race with their own legends, their own rituals, their own pantheon of deities.
They just happen to live in what the surface world called it hell. And then the trolls came from hell when the sun died, because the sun drove them out, essentially.
And yeah, when he died, all the light.
Yeah, because all the light went underneath the ground into hell. And then the trolls were like, ah, I can't live here anymore. Let's go up to the surface. And here come the trolls, eating everything. Sorry, Ash, I jumped in there.
Are really interesting, because if you think of a standard fantasy troll as being what a grand person who'd never met a troll before kind of sees. So it's like, oh, there's this thing that's big, it's strong, it doesn't look like me, it wants to eat stuff, I don't know what's going on, it's scary, let's kill it. And that's like your standard troll, but it's the Birthing Age of Grand Patrol. But Grand Patrol is, okay, well, that's your first impression of it if you've never encountered a troll before, but they have, you know, deep, meaningful lives with gods
in fact partially responsible for fighting off chaos and saving the world. Mm-hmm. That's like the
absolutely.
Great part.
They helped save the world and are continuing to fight chaos and save the world. The trolls are one of the things I like about Glorantha is that there are no absolute heroes. The trolls are heroes because they're fighting off chaos, but at the same time, they're also creatures of darkness, which the races of light, of course, were in opposition to, but everybody's in opposition to chaos, because chaos wants to destroy the world, corrupt the world, end everything. So it's this really interesting dynamic where the hero from one nation might be the villain from another. It's this really cool setting there.
I think that there's an element when you ask what is the marriage of 13th Age and Glorantha, and what sense does that make? I will say that one of the biggest influences is that Glorantha's perspectivism and ability to say, look, there's many possible things that are true, influenced 13th Age in the way that we suggest to game masters, you know, there's a lot of different ways that something could be true here, and you can choose which truth you really want to emphasize in this individual campaign. And I think both Jonathan and I really associate that with Glorantha. Ironically, sometimes Glorantha's campaigns don't, in fact, get to delve into all those possibilities because they're playing, like, you know, in one clan or they're playing in one area. And I think that partly what we're trying to do with 13th Age and Glorantha is to open up the spectrum of what Glorantha games will look like from all these different angles and from all these different campaign styles. Just as 13th Age campaigns, man, you can have campaigns that just don't look anything alike, but they're playing 13th Age, maybe even in the Dragon Empire, and that is something that we're going to be definitely using as much as we can, which partially gives hope to, there's an awful lot of writers and fans, the designers who have made up their own things in Glorantha over the years, and this is an opportunity to bring them back. Different, you know, heretical viewpoints will be welcome inside campaigns, and I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Well, very cool. I feel like I could have just outsourced my blog post to you, Rob. because the gist of it when I put it up is that even though I've never been able to run a game in Glorantha, and that's why I'm really excited about 13th Age, mainly because the marriage of Glorantha and RuneQuest back in the day, and I couldn't get people to play RuneQuest. Everything I've touched since reading Glorantha is Glorantha-n. Like, Nick and Mark have played in my games, and so they may not realize it, but, you know, on my world, the mineral that makes magic items possible is the crystallized bones of gods when they've died, and gods rise and fall and change and morph, and their histories and their mythologies continually move. And so, yeah, I was like,
awesome.
I've never run Glorantha, but it's touched everything that I've done creatively since I've read it.
That is a very good way to put it. So we're, and certainly the goal for us is to, you know, the other funny part about this is the part that I haven't even begun to think about is the rebound that will happen for 13th Age. And, you know, I know it exists. I just haven't, I sort of amused myself. I'm not thinking about it yet, except to go, oh, yeah, then if you take this, you know, and if you take Mistcrawling and then that goes to 13th Age, what does that look like? And it's like, wow. So,
let's talk about Mistcrawling.
We should, and Ash, you should take on, because that is the question about hero questing. It's a really cool part of Glorantha. You should go into that for a second.
Okay, so one of the big things in Glorantha is hero questing. And what this looks like is you kind of dress up like people in myth. So you put on clothes that represent them, you paint yourselves to look like them, whatever the hero quest requires. And you start acting out the hero quest. And at some point, you pass into the god realm, into the god time. You take on the roles of these mythic heroes, maybe even the roles of gods, and you replay in the god realm the legends of old. And because you're going into the god time, it's a timeless time before time. So you're not only replaying these legends, you're reinforcing the legends. You're actually helping that god do that particular thing in the way back when. And if you do really well, you can really help to reinforce a particular myth, and that has a reflection upon reality. So you can come out of a hero quest and you're more powerful, or you come out of it with a magic item or knowledge of some sort of magic. Or it can go horribly, horribly wrong. And if it goes wrong often enough or big enough, then you end up adversely affecting the world. That you end up changing, morphing history, because you are the world is a living myth. Everything is mythic. So when you do a hero quest, that's what happens. So with this we got something called that Rob likes to call myth crawling, which is kind of like a dungeon crawl. So in a traditional dungeon crawl, you enter the dungeon, and then there's a room, and you defeat whatever's in the room, and do you go left, or do you go... Well, it's the same thing, but you enter a myth, and then you encounter a station of this myth. So you come across Orlanth, and Orlanth needs a net in order to catch this rolling wheel that represents self-doubt. Okay, so he does... Do you, as Orlanth, on this quest, manage to catch the wheel in the net? If so, then the myth goes this way. If not, then the myth goes this way. And you can actually end up going so oddly that you end up in another myth entirely. So you're like, I don't know, suddenly I'm in hell, and there's this guy called Grandfather Mortal, and there's this sword here. What happens now? I take
Well, I really hope you brought a Humakti. And that is exactly how it works. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a big part of what we're doing. It's going to show up in the organized play for 13th Age in Glorantha, which I'm really keen to get into. So that organized play program is going to give us a chance to revisit some classic Glorantha RuneQuest hero quest adventures, but revisit them in a new way.
Griffin Mountain.
But to provide new stuff for. So So if you've been to Snake Pike Hollow before, you'll be able to visit Snake Pike Hollow again, but it's not going to be quite how you remember it, perhaps. There's going to be some surprises. There's going to be some new stuff.
So when in Glorantha is it set?
Rob, go ahead. I was about to say in the Third Age, kind of now.
I actually have this is a funny one because this is an example of what I thought and then talking with Jeff Richard about how he's thinking of things. I know that the way we can really do things is we can phrase things in a way that allow people to really run, people who know Glorantha to run it anytime they really want to. But for people who are new to the setting, Jeff is suggesting that even if we don't come out and just say it and put a date in, which we probably won't do, it's going to be after all of the games that have been previously done, like HeroQuest and RuneQuest. And those RPGs, they are set in a time when the Lunar Empire is bossing Dragon Path. But there are some very big things that everybody knows, you know, who reads the canonical version, that there's a dragon that's going to unearth itself and eat a whole bunch of the lunars and eat one of their temples, and other things are going to happen. And we're, therefore, what Jeff is suggesting is that we place it into that wild period after those events where actually, and that is where the Dragon Pass board game, the game that was originally White Bear Red Moon, is set. All the heroes are fighting in Dragon Pass. We're capable of it. All the dragons are active. Everything is in play. And since our game is partly about the idea that something so big has happened that chaos has really erupted into the world in a way that is just out of control and needs to be dealt with, that really works perfectly. So if you say, when is it set? Well, it's set after RuneQuest and HeroQuest in a way, if you want it to be. And it's set in a zone where the big events of the Dragon Pass board game and the wide open possibilities for what's going on in Dragon Pass are accessible to anybody who already really knows Glorantha and wants to, you know, experiment with what could happen after the period that HeroQuest covers. So that's a little bit different than what I was thinking at first, but I really like it. The more I think about it, the more I really like Jeff's idea, and so I'm pretty happy with it. And it's definitely going to come through. You'll see pieces, elements of it, just a little bit in the Kickstarter too, because there's a crazy reward level which is says pick a counter, and pick a counter means choose a counter from the game Dragon Pass, and we will go ahead and stat up creatures and things from that counter. And put them into this game. So the various pieces of Glorantha that have been sort of hard to access before are coming to the front, which I'm really happy about.
Very cool.
Well, you guys both sound really excited about this, and James is very excited about this. What would you guys say is the part about this book and this project that you're most excited about?
I'll
answer first. You're talking. Okay, go. Chaos?
Okay. So chaos is a big thing in Glorantha. So if you're a British listener listening to this, yeah, Glorantha is really where the whole kind of chaos as a force starts. In fact, yeah, I mean, Gygaxian chaos is a force, law and chaos, and yeah, it's this chaos is this big force which wants to end everything, but wants to corrupt everything and end everything. So, you know, force of darkness might want to kill you, but, you know, your village is still going to be there. The hill that your village is on is still going to be there, but, you know, and your time that you will have existed. Whereas chaos just wants to end everything, to return everything to non-existence. And you can't really negotiate with that. And there are some people who think, oh, I can be a sorcerer and like deal with chaos, unique chaos to have change. That's just belies, but chaos tells you to get you to go along with chaos. But ultimately, chaos wants to corrupt you. So I'm looking forward to a really chaotic take on Brew. Brew are this race within the setting that can more or less mate with a anything. So most brews that you encounter will be brews that are kind of look a bit like goats or cows or a mixture thereof. But you'll also have other brew can mate with just about anything. So while we think of them as goat men, I'm looking forward to like real weird chimeric mix, horrible.
I love it. I love it. This is great. The question is, Ash, what are you most looking forward to? Oh, man, I just love this. Well, I'm British. I'm British. And there's just this chaotic creature that can mate with anything.
So I'm looking forward to, I've done a lot more chaotic stuff for the book. We'll see what actually gets in past Rob's great. He's my crazy idea filter, where he says, and Rob has a wonderful way of saying no. He says, well, that's possible, but let me think about that.
Oh my goodness. So I think the thing that Ash is being very careful about here, the fun part is, the reason that he's actually so excited about chaos is that he's coming up with very interesting 13th Age mechanics and implementations of things that will be exciting and strange and different to play, and will add to 13th Age games. Chaos wants to unmake the universe, but it's our responsibility to make that fun. And Ash is, the translation that between the destroy everything and how is that fun for a game? That's the key part, and I think that's definitely worth being excited about.
I think the really fun thing about chaos is that the worst thing that chaos can do is not that chaos kills you. The worst thing that can happen is that you survive chaos, and that chaos messes you up. And stuff that you walk away from, and you're like, man, I never want to fight one of those again, because yeah, we beat it, but it's just not worth tangling with it.
that's right. Yep. And the little Prince of Starter web comic that is on the web right now and accessible through the Glorantha pages, has, in the boys initiation, where they're like talking about the, how the early, how the gods, the air gods, each had these challenges, and then that, but one of the brothers did not do so well, and it's like that, and he becomes one of the big chaotic gods, that like basically, I think that element of exposure, we still have to make it fun, but it is going to be dangerous. It's going to be hazardous, and I think that in a certain way, there's a possibility that camp, some stories could be pretty deep and about real wounds to the world that have to be healed or not.
Well, we've had two false starts on the Kickstarter. Do you think you actually are going to go live on Monday?
I think so. Yeah, I think it'll be live by then. And in fact, since this is happening afterwards, I guess we'll know for sure. I'm not positive when you're planning to air this. Yes, I believe so. It looked like everything was together today.
Excellent.
All
healed up.
I'm also, but I'm not going to, but yes, if I knew for certain right this second, I would just tell you, yeah, absolutely for sure. But there's still something technical that has to be worked out. So I believe the answer is yes. Now, I wanted to get to my favorite part because it is connected to what Ash said. And we already talked about Mistcrawling, but the piece of it, the thing that I'm really happy about is that many of the myths, you can't have a Glorantha book without myths. So we're going to have myths printed in the book. Simultaneously, we're inserting the playable elements that let you play the myth directly into the myth. So you're not reading myths and then later on having an adventure about it. See, many of the myths are, you can skip the stuff that's the play mechanics the first time you read it, but there are pieces in it that show you how it gets played. And of course, there are options so that the players don't know which version they're hitting. And, and when Ash described the things that chaos can do, chaos monsters oftentimes come with, the way they interface, they intersect with a myth and destroy part of it as part of the monster write-up. And that style of approach I'm pretty excited about, too.
That's very cool. Well, any hints on stretch goals, or are we going to be able to unlock ducks as a playable race?
I'm laughing. Okay. I can tell you one hint for sure.
No pressure.
You certainly have, you have the right idea, because the initial plans for the book don't include all the elder races. Hmm. But they're definitely, you know, it's like, come on, man. I used a picture of a dancing troll on the postcard.
Right.
That says dance. And if the Kickstarter does well, I would love, you know, I would love to see trolls in as a playable race. So I think that's there's your hint.
Okay.
That's a pretty good one.
Mark is looking at me like ducks. And Chris was the one who wanted to know it. Our buddy Chris.
No. I'm just trying to give you the evil eye, because I see more money coming out of my wallet to buy Glorantha and contribute to the Kickstarter, and I'm kind of interested now. Yeah.
Well, we worked hard on our subliminal messages to thread through this episode, yes. So it's good to see they're working.
So the people who never encountered Glorantha before are going to be listening to this and going, duh. That's a playable race? When I first encountered Glorantha, I was like, ducks? Really? I'm warming to ducks. I might one day play a duck. So dear listener at home, ducks are actually a pretty awesome race which exists in Glorantha, and may exist in this one tiny part of the world. And their mythology says, but once upon a time, every race had feathers and beaks and stuff. Yeah, because there's two sets of them, isn't there? There's two
sure.
Separate.
You see, this is what happens whenever somebody brings up ducks. It's like suddenly the podcast, yes,
they totally, you know, everybody used to, but now the races didn't fight hard enough against chaos or something, and they got all cursed, and the ducks are the only ones who stood firm against undeath. And therefore, they're not cursed. And everybody else lost their beaks and feathers, and now they're all ugly. And yet the ducks are the only true people left. And that's their legend. And for them, it's a totally true thing, of course. Ducks, they're you know, secret holdovers from the beginning of time. And everybody else is like, well, I don't know what the ducks did to get cursed, but it must be something really bad. So you've got these conflicting legends about why the world is the way the world is, and it's all kind of true.
I know that you know, in the future, I would say that sometime in the future, you know, 13th Age and Glorantha, people playing games, obviously ducks have got to be there someday. I don't know if they'll be part of this book or not. I'm not sure. They could be, but I'm not positive.
If JM runs this when he's done with his masters, I'm playing a duck paladin.
All right.
Do it.
Excellent. Well, there's actually, if you really, you know, I just was thinking for a second, and I realized something that I don't know if I'm remembering something that I once knew or if it just occurred to me, but talking about how, you know, Glorantha is in the Tolkien world, but the duck is funny because they are these little tiny people who only exist in one place. And they're basically peaceful, except that they're also involved in, like, killing the zombies that are of the, you know, they are the zombie suppression unit for Delecting, you know, to keep down Delecting and the necromancers. And so I had this realization all of a sudden that, wow, my God, ducks are like the hobbits. No wonder they catch so much black, because they're really out of place, except there they are. So very funny.
I like that about Glorantha, that there's you know, you turn over a rock and you're like, wow, there's this whole other, it's like the real world. Glorantha's like that, but you can, because you are very often playing somebody who is basically from a tribal or landy cattle raiding culture. You meet somebody who looks a bit different from you. You're not actually sure certain that they're human. But, you know, maybe they're human, maybe they're not. They have green skin, or they're an elf. They're actually a plant, or they're a duck. Were they cursed? Are they a different species? It's this wonderful world as process of discovery. I like it.
Cool. I have a final question. You mentioned about fighting the chaos as they try to destroy the myth. So what happens when they destroy the myth completely? What happens?
That's going to depend on the myth. I mean, so, you know, if the myth is related to, for instance, like, let's say the myth is about how Orlanth got a particular weapon that enabled them to go ahead and kill a particular dragon. And if Chaos goes ahead and destroys the myth so that Orlanth doesn't have that weapon, then two things happen probably. And one of them is that Chaos has the weapon, which is going to make things worse for your campaign. And the other is that dragon never died.
Yeah, so just whatever happened.
Also gonna make, yeah.
Yes, so it just never happens.
Or
erases the timeline.
Well, it changes the world. So it's like, I think that you try not to get into time travel stuff too much. And it's not time travel exactly, but it's like the things that you knew as true aren't true anymore. Definitely happens. Now sometimes it's just the local area. The ripple may not be big enough. The effect may not be big enough to destroy, to affect the entire world. But it could be that, for as an example, HeroQuest goes really terribly badly, and you guys and Chaos has won. And then it turns out that everything within 50 miles of that particular valley, Chaos has that weapon, and dragons are much more powerful than they should be. That's a better example because it's a localized thing. And then it tells you as the player characters, you go outside and you leave your problem behind, you go somewhere else, and you don't have to deal with that anymore. But, you are responsible for wrecking something, and it'll probably get worse if you don't fix it. So I think that the local consequences, that when they pile up, get, bigger and bigger and bigger, that's how Chaos usually works. I believe that we'll be, the campaigns will be tracking the amount of Chaos, the sort of the strength of it, and that's the style of thing that the new Icon relationship system is actually involved with, too. So the big answer is that's part of the definition of each playable myth. What happens if this goes wrong?
So kind of like how the Icons in 13th Age have everything's okay unless...
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Which means there's an awful lot more opportunities for things to go wrong.
One of the things I'm excited about is dragon snails. I would like to have a playable myth involving dragon snails.
Oh yeah, totally.
And so dragon snails are like, okay, they're giant fire breathing snails. Okay. And I would, and have an outcome of that myth be, okay, so you failed this hero quest really, really badly.
Really failed. Right.
Guess what? Dragon snails are now much bigger, and they move quicker, and they've got two heads, and they spit acid, and all these terrible, horrible things that dragons, because you did that. You made the myth go wrong.
That's right. And so what Ash is tapping into there, he's tapping into the fact that your history with particular myths in each campaign will, in a certain sense, shape the campaign. So, if you have a campaign that has a really, really bad moment with dragon snails early on, and then you try to do something about it, but you fail, your campaign, part of it is going to end up with the consequences of having screwed up with dragon snails, and that's going to be part of the mythic tapestry, of that particular game. And So it's not only going to be the characters' one unique things and backgrounds that will be shaping things. It'll also be the choices they make about interacting with the God Time and the outcome of those hero quests. It's going to be a very interesting tapestry.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking. Do you have any final thoughts on anything you want to share?
I'm just so excited. I mean, I've had the Dragon Pass map up on my wall ever since it came out, and ex-girlfriend who didn't know anything about gaming, but when I told her what the project was, and she was like, "Oh, that map you had on the wall." I'm like, "Yes, that one exactly." And so
this is a dream. It's a great thing to do, an awful lot of responsibility. I'm super excited and really glad to be working with Ash and Jonathan and Jeff. And I think that four of us is a good number of eyes in different directions, and definitely got a whole lot of different skills, and I'm glad it's going to be go.
I'm very excited to be working on something with such a lineage. The game world that predates D&D is just a chance to get to work on it is mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's a great thing. It's like when you're talking about inheriting part of the mantle of the great charismatic leader, it doesn't get any better than Greg Stafford's mantle. So we have a huge responsibility and a glorious charge. So thanks for having us on the podcast. I strongly suspect we'll be talking to you again.
Oh yes. Look forward to it.
Look forward to it. Okay.
Well, Rob, I was just gonna...
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.
Okay.
So you were telling us that Greg Stafford, creator of Glorantha and RuneQuest, was the first person to buy Dungeons & Dragons?
The very first person to buy Dungeons & Dragons. He had a friend who was picking stuff up at a print shop for him and was who are you? What are you doing here? The guy was Gary Gygax and was picking up the very, very first printing of Dungeons & Dragons. And Greg's friend said, "Well, I've got a friend who would really like that. I should get that from my friend Greg." So it got picked up for Greg, posted to Greg. So Greg was the first person, apart from, of course, Gary Gygax, to have a copy of D&D. He was the first person to buy it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I got and, and he doesn't have it anymore.
Oh, no.
He doesn't have the very first copy of D&D anymore. It's somewhere.
So just lost her, so he didn't sell it and regrets it now.
I don't know. You would have to ask him that.
I know that was my story. I sold it. I would suspect Greg. I would guess he didn't sell it. And something else happened to it.
Well, that's good.
But
I can accept that.
Yeah.
My story is the opposite. I didn't have it, and then a friend, his father died, and his father had been collecting stuff since the dawn of a hobby and had very first printing D&D. So now that's on my shelf. It's not pristine, though. It's
wow. Pristine. Well, come on. It's not meant to be pristine.
Right.
But, I mean, a pristine copy would be weird, Ash. That would be like
separate
gamers.
One of the little booklets had an illustration of it. I think it must be a succubus or something.
Yes.
I've never had it, and I'm strongly suspecting it was this guy's dad's mom, I don't know, his grandfather.
Yeah.
Anyway, somebody cut out a little felt bikini from this succubus and has glued it onto the succubus.
That's fantastic.
Give the succubus clothing in that first printing of Dungeons & Dragons. So.
My copy of the Advanced Player's Guide has some creative coloring in it. From whoever I purchased it from, I was flipping through it, and I'm like, oh, well, there you go.